You're listening to the Art of Move podcast, hosted by Dr. William Raybar and Anthony Manuel, where we attempt to create a grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, and training. If you enjoy these episodes, you can watch them streamed live on nofilter.net, where you can interact directly and have all your questions answered in real time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my good friend, Dr. William Raybar. We are now both out in the Canadian Rockies again, here to try and find the grand unified theory of human movement and biomechanics. Today, we're going to do a little bit of a freestyle jam. We're going to maybe do a recap of some of the other stuff that we talked about in recent episodes. We're going to kind of cover what we've been doing for our own training and exploration, stuff that's been on our minds, interesting conversations that we've had, maybe pull up a few videos and chirp a couple of people. We'll see, right? We're going to kind of go in a multitude of different directions today. I'd love to start with what we're both doing, what we're both exploring in terms of movement in our own training, different stimuli that we're implementing into our own lives and the effects that we've gotten from those. What's kind of been your practice looking like lately? And, you know, what are things that you're experimenting with?
Well, I always have the baseline of walking a lot. Like I have two dogs, three sometimes, and I go out and I walk a lot, right? So that's the basis of my training, nice meditative in the mountains and nature. That's baseline, right? I've been getting into shuffle dancing, just learning a skill, which is really good because it integrates a lot with the bounding movements that I love. And it's a skill and it crosses over into boxing and it crosses over into athleticism. Like if you can shuffle dance, you're in balance. Okay. Like watch shuffle dancing and tell me that they're not athletic. Right. So I think it's fantastic. And I bounce between that and like shadow boxing a lot and doing Cobra bag work. And I've been working a lot with the inertia wave. I don't know if you guys ever seen it. It's a elastic recoil, kind of like, what are they called? Ropes. Except that in, with the inertia wave, it's giving you the energy back. So it's more of a pulsing motion. And I've been doing a lot of long range training. There's the ATG influence, right? But not really. Long range training and doing a lot of pulsing maneuvers in my long range movements. Very specific, but let's say I'm doing a an overhead motion. I'll have my arms way up. I'm working on getting really, really out there with my scapulas. I'll work with different positions and then I'll bounce in that position, right? And I'll have the inertia move back and forth and I have to control that and I have to pulse my muscles. If you pulse at the right time, the rope actually bounces further. So you gain momentum. And I do the same thing in like I guess you would call it a bow position, but one leg back and I'm bouncing up and down in that bow shaped leg and it's gaining inertia. And then I just go and do my thing. So I do more of multiple times per day, a little bit, and then some skill work in between. What about you?
Nice. Just to kind of touch on that, that end range stuff with the inertia wave, it almost sounds like you're building a reactive stability, right? Like in that end range position, rather than trying to just do repetitions in like an extreme end range position, you're allowing your muscles to like naturally pulse in response to some inertia, you know, like the rhythm that's actually happening with the inertia wave.
Yeah. And I can tell you what I'm doing in my head. So in my head, I have certain positions I get into, and this is one I like a lot, overhead motion, grabbing the inertia wave when it's pulling behind me. Okay. So I'm almost doing a cable overhead. You know how bodybuilders do this cable overhead or skull crusher type maneuver, except that I can think about different parts. So I can have my spine way long. I can have my scapulas into it. I can feel different parts of my body and I can work internal rotations, kind of like getting the last little bit of tension into different parts of my body. Right. So I can think of my forearms crushing, my hands getting that last little bit of tension coming up and just letting it bounce in that position. Right. And it feels amazing. And it, I feel that elastic reactivity afterwards. Right. So I don't know how to quantify this, but I've been feeling really, really good, more athletic. And, I'm looking forward to doing this more and seeing where it goes.
That's sweet, man. That's super cool. I might have to get like, I have this growing collection of like random training tools. I guess that's how it is when you have, you know, when you're obsessed with it. Right. But, I actually just got these two, like 2 pound, whatever plyo balls, I guess you could call them. They're full of sand.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been using them
for a variety of different things from different systems. I did a couple of sessions with Nathan from MoveMed, and he got me to kind of put them in my armpits at one point, and sort of I get like a scapular position, a lot of compression, and you know, a lot of flexing, pumping sort of action in my musculature. And one of the things that I notice is after I do this like really intense compressive maneuver, when I release it, I feel like there's less compression in that area. It's almost like decompression through compression.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And that's been kind of interesting. I also do one where it's in my bicep. I almost do like a back double bicep thing. And this one is really interesting because when I finish doing that, I find I have this really nice range of internal rotation in my shoulders that I don't normally have access to. Like my post-op surgical shoulder still has like a little sensitivity in hanging positions and extreme internal rotation positions. And that like basically goes away after doing those two movements. Aside from that.
And how long is that lasting?
It usually lasts like, I don't have to do it very often. I do it like once a week, you know, and it's like, basically if I start to feel funky, I kind of do it reactively. I'd like to do it more consistently to see if it has more long lasting benefits. If I have it as part of a regular practice, I'm doing some of the reactive stability stuff that Devin from One of a Kind teaches, which has been kind of interesting, you know, with the actual sand, instead of I was using a propulsor before. So I was using like the Weck method propulsors to do the sort of behind the back shakes and the sort of reactive stability pulses that he gets you to do. So I've been kind of experimenting with that a little bit. That always feels really good because same thing, in the same way that you have the inertia wave, you kind of feel a pulse once you connect. So like my intention is basically create a feeling where I feel like my pec and my lat connect at the shoulder girdle, get my scapula set flush to my rib cage. And then I get that pulsing motion. I feel the pulse kind of through that whole shoulder complex, and that helps it kind of move as an entire unit. So that's been really helpful in that sense. I didn't have any of this stuff when I was in Mexico for the last month, and I was experimenting a lot. So I was setting up bands and trying to create sort of different force vectors that could maybe emulate like a combination of lifting in a locomotive pattern. So trying to sequence contractions and muscles in a way that would sequence an entire entire part of the kinetic chain as it would show up in locomotion. Like I did one type of bicep curl where I started an internal rotation with my arm behind my back with a dumbbell. The dumbbell was maybe attached to a band anchored to a squat rack behind me. And then I would step forward into my other column while twisting it up in the way that my arm would kind of pump in a sprint, right? So when my arms are pumping in a sprint, I would basically emulate that. And it was kind of like a bicep curl with my whole body in a locomotive pattern. And so I was doing some stuff like that, trying to experiment with just creating those force vectors and adding a form of resistance training to a sequence that would show up in a locomotive pattern.
So that would, a couple things would beg the question. It's how much of that, let's say chain, are you working there? Like how much intention do you have? And could you name each part that you're actually doing there? Do you know what I mean? Like how much are you linking within the whole body? And is doing it in a slow motion going to reverb and give you the same thing that a sprint would? I'm not saying it wouldn't. I'm asking the question. What do you think?
Right. Well, you know, the way that I was thinking about it is like when I used to deadlift, I could jump higher straight up or slightly backwards. Right. Okay. And so like when I was working that kinetic chain, it translated to that particular pattern of movement. And that was like a lot of contraction. And I wasn't deadlifting super fast all the time. I was making sure that everything was super tight and connected. And I was working that particular chain. And then I was able to access that in a dynamic way later. Very limited in the way that I could access it, right? Like I could jump higher from deadlifting and I could jump backwards. I could, you know, conceivably do a backflip at some point because I could, you know, have that backwards jumping, that backwards propulsion motion. So in terms of like what parts of the chain was I looking to sequence specifically? Well, I mean, I started at my foot, right? So I have all my cues for my foot. I was trying to create a strong dome shape with my foot. if you want to say the inside ankle bone high, I don't really think inside ankle bone high anymore. I think almost like vacuum the dome. So I almost think there's like a vacuum sucking the dome. I spread my toes out, suck the dome up, and then put some pressure through my big toe to really emphasize. So like my body weight is on the fourth and fifth metatarsal, my big toe is anchoring, and then there's this strong like almost suction force that happens as a result of like a spiraling torque up my leg. And that's kind of like my that's my first internal cue. Mm-hmm. Then I pull my hips back and I try to position my hips so that I feel a maximal amount of tension in my hamstrings, glutes, and lateral calf. And that's sort of like I'm trying to connect that first. From there, you know, positioning my head over that column, making sure that my shoulders are integrated, and then initiating the movement from that tension in that back chain activated leg, and pulling through with the shoulder, mm-hmm. in a way that like kind of feels like that extension of the lat, that, you know, that I'm really trying to like stretch my lat forward when I come forward. And then when I come back, I want to have that integration of the chest and lat as I get that internal rotation behind my back. So that's cool. That was like my internal cueing, was like make sure that all that tension is maintained throughout that entire process. And I don't know how effective it is. I don't know if the accommodating resistance of the band, where it's like highest tension at the end versus like, you know, a minimal amount of tension. But I was kind of thinking, it's like, okay, well, I got the bicep curl element, right? You know, I got a dumbbell, so I got the force coming down when I come forward. And then that last little bit, as I'm pushing through that band, that's when it like is at max tension. So maybe I can have that follow through be that max tension point while still, you know, trying to hold that dumbbell up. So it was, you know, I don't know if it's perfect. It's probably not, but it was definitely an interesting thing to experiment with.
Yeah. And that's the whole thing about like this niche. I love experimenting, right? Like, which brings me so many thoughts, but one was the other day I asked somebody, I'm not going to mention who, I'm like, how do you prove what you're doing? And I think he thought I meant, where's your science? Right. And then he got a little upset and I'm like, no, I just want to know how you know this. And he's like, oh, well, like just experimental. I'm like, great. That's awesome. Right. Like I think that experimenting is the key, right? Like you can have a base, whatever base you have is your way to know things, whether it be, let's say you start with the research, then go to experiment from there, or you have your guru, right? Whatever, whoever it is, guru to me just means like somebody you look up to. I shouldn't even use that word because it's tainted, but somebody you look up to who has done this more than you as a starting point, and then you go and experiment. I think experimenting is absolutely key, right? So I think it's great. And I don't think you have to start with the scientific research necessarily, right? It may be a good place to start, and it is a good place to start if you don't know anything, but to go to somebody who is passionate about it, who does it themselves, who has results, I think that's fantastic, right? So that's awesome. And the only issue would be, how do you quantify, like, there's so many variables in that, you know, that motion that you were showing there. And it's like, this is pulling that way, that's coming up this way, and I'm doing all these other things. It's like, how do you know actually what's working? It's probably pretty hard to separate.
Well, in terms of there's two factors here, right? There's the external resistance, and then there's the internal intention, right? So this is where it could be hard to quantify, where it's like, okay, I'm setting up the band, have this force vector this way. I'm thinking in terms of the force vector of the, you know, the downward force of gravity on the dumbbell. When I'm here, I had a smaller dumbbell rotating back when I came forward, so I had like a counterweight kind of thing going on. And it would be kind of hard to quantify, because I'm also very good at like actively contracting my muscles in, you know, without an exogenous load, right? So I could be tricking myself into thinking, oh yeah, it's a great stimulus, like I'm actually like I'm going against this resistance, when in reality I'm just like consciously contracting my muscles in the way that I want to contract them despite the load, right? And so there are a lot of variables there. And I was kind of working on a set of locomotive pattern principles and joint integration principles, and basically implementing a resistance in the way that I perceived, you know, how, like, I find I like, I don't necessarily pump my shoulders forward super hard when I sprint, But my lats kind of inhibit the motion forward and pull them back. And then I pump my arms back. And then there's a bit of a natural pump forward without a lot of effort. So in that sense, so I was working this like resistance forward. Now, to work the other side of the sprint, right, that pumping back, I was doing a dumbbell swing where I kind of went into like almost what you would call a go to drop in with a dumbbell. And I was swinging a dumbbell in front and then going into a drop in. But as I went into the drop in, I would pump my arm up almost like I'm pumping my arm in a sprint. So I have this big 50-pound dumbbell and I'm taking the inertia and the momentum and I'm pumping it up and forcing my pec and my shoulder essentially to reflexively stop this momentum of this 50-pound weight that I just pulsed up really hard. And I'm trying to get that arm pump from the sprint, right? And so I'm doing this unilateral swing, pumping my elbow up in the pattern that I want to pump my arms during a sprint, trying to teach that reflexive stretch reflex in the front of the shoulder and in the pec and in the lat. And again, trying to keep that principle of integrating those different parts of the shoulder just to keep that bounce going.
Interesting. Yeah. I wonder if 50 pounds would reflexively keep without like the same without body weight. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting thought, right? So, yeah, those are all interesting. Like, I mean, experiment away and see what happens there. Yeah.
The thing that I should do is actually be more deliberate about like creating before and afters of my gait. Right. The one thing that I noticed is that I was getting my arm pump a lot better after a couple of weeks of doing this, but I was also actively thinking about the arm pump while I was doing it, because that's something that I wanted to work in terms of my sprinting technique. So actually having, yes, experiment, but when you're experimenting, make sure that you're actually testing something as well. Like, you know, playing around with a movement is kind of cool. Figuring something out is one part of the experiment. Once you've figured out like the sensation and the intention and the feeling and the stimulation effect of something, then having some sort of measurable variable to see if there's an effect, you know, like you actually like you, yeah, an experiment is basically you're testing something, right? So it's like, what am I actually testing here?
Well, you'd want to isolate the variable. You'd only want to do one at a time, right? Like if you wanted to know if one thing was working, you would do one at a time and you'd do it repetitively over a period of time, however you wanted to set it up and do it that way, right? So that would be if you wanted to actually have like a scientific experiment conducted on it. But you don't have to, right? You can do your thing and see what happens there, right? Like I don't think every individual is going to want to do a scientific experiment on themselves, right? So yeah, that would be how you would do it scientifically, is isolate the variable, cause and effect.
All I'm saying is to like, take a look at the results you're getting too. Like, and it's, if you change a million things at once, it is going to be hard to say like what thing is getting results. And the other thing about like testing independent variables, I was thinking about this. It's like, cause especially in nutrition science, this is pretty insidious where people will test like in vitro things with like one chemical component of food, not taking into consideration how that one chemical component in like interacts with all the other chemical components of food in the process of digestion, right? And so people will draw these like broad sweeping conclusions on mechanistic data or biochemical data of like how one component of food will interact, when in reality the food that it's a part of behaves completely differently when you actually eat it. And so I think sometimes it's like, yeah, you can test like individual variables in these super controlled environments to test what kind of results you'll get. But the reality is like, you are doing a gazillion other things. You are, you know, sitting in certain ways, you are having other training stimuluses, and you are having different, stressors in your life, and good sleep, bad sleep, nutrition, all these other variables will impact the type of results that you get. And so you can test, I guess, acute stimuli and see what kind of results you get. But I think there's also something to be said about like taking your own life and testing things in the broader context of the totality of your life and seeing what kind of results you get without isolating each and every separate little tiny variable.
Yeah, that's a good point, because isolating variables is already a paradigm. It's a paradigm of like how the biomedical model works, right? Like one variable, one result, one cure. And that's how you would do it, right? Like you isolate one variable. That doesn't take into account a lot of things, like where you are mentally, spiritually, physically, at the time as you're doing it, right? And would your result work with another person given their physiology and mental state at the point, at the time that they're doing it, right? So, what was I going to say about that? That kind of begs the question there. How, like, every individual is not going to do their own scientific research. And since it's very hard to isolate single variables to what is working, and of course you have to define what's working, that's where the importance of having a blueprint comes into play. Do you get what I'm saying? So like, I do go back to the gait cycle, but I actually go back further than that and say, and again, I think Goda has this correct of looking at the body in columns, having rotational movements. Okay, so I'm bringing it back to very simplistic terms here, right? I look at the body two columns, not necessarily that you have to be in columns all the time. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, look at the body in two columns. You have energy moving in a circular pattern in both columns. Is it organized in both columns, right? Mm-hmm. Are you moving energy efficiently up the chain? I would say in a pressure wave, right? So if I visualize that, that is what I can go back to as a blueprint, so that it is something simple to go back to, right? Because nobody's going to do, again, I can say no one's going to do scientific research on themselves and isolate variables. It's very hard to look at a paper and say, oh, that's what did it there. Even the scientists are having a hard time doing this. It's like, let's take Brett Contreras's work. It's like hip thrusts versus deadlifts versus squats. What's getting you faster at a 60 meter? It's like, how many variables are there already? You know what I mean? Like, besides looking at three different things, it's already like, how fast are you going? That's one very like outcome measure that is already has so many other things, right? Because it's like, you did one experiment one time with high school athletes, that is one, or college athletes, that's one cohort. They're athletes, they're already jacked, they're already in good shape. And there's so many variables there already. Like, I could probably take that apart and say that there's 100 variables there, right? So already when you're trying to isolate one single easy thing, squats, hip thrusts, or deadlifts, that slices itself into like 100 different variables. So it's pretty impossible to do this type of scientific study in this field anyway. To really, really actually isolate a variable is very difficult. So again, that's what the importance, I think, of the blueprint, having something to go back to. I still think Goda's is the easiest to look at in terms of what I was saying before. I think there is a human blueprint. Forget about Goda for a second. There is a human blueprint in my vision, right? And the blueprint is something to go back to work to, whether you want to get there doing, you know, functional patterns, WEC method, Goda, MoveMed, like all those different ones, right? To me, even though they don't say it, there is a human blueprint to movement. We have a skeletal structure, like a car has a chassis, and it has certain functions, and our tissues have certain functions. And to me, it's having a pressure wave that's nice and clean, going up and putting energy through your body in a clean fashion, and your bones, you align them up as you go, and you use your elasticity to help propel your bones in a rhythmic fashion, in a circular fashion. Energy moves around a corner when I do this. When I punch, my fist always goes like that, unless I'm fighting Irish doing that old school, right? Fist always goes like that. Your leg does the same thing. It doesn't go like this when you punch. That is really, really hard to do, first of all. And I mean, you could do it, but it's very unnatural, right? This is natural. Same with your leg. It's going, it's doing a spinning motion. The body moves in circular patterns. Your body twists muscles. Okay. So your pecs, your lats, your glutes, your Achilles, they're all inserted twisting, right? The body has this twisting pattern, and that is, and crossing patterns. Let's say your glutes and your external oblique and your oblique muscles have a continuous crossing pattern, and that is to do the internal-external torques of your hips, your pelvis and your ribs, and those match up in a smooth fashion as you run in alignment in general, okay? They want to be aligned so that you can move energy through your body in an efficient manner, right? So again, easy blueprint to go back to, not isolating variables, a new paradigm introduced, go back to a blueprint. That's an appeal to nature, okay? I admit it. It's a quote-unquote logical fallacy to appeal to nature, but I don't care because it is something I go back to. And hey, you can believe it or not.
Well, I don't necessarily think, like an appeal to nature in the way that you're explaining it, where it's like, I think an appeal to nature would be something like, oh, lions eat meat and they're totally fine. Or like a gorilla eats nothing but grass and they're super muscular. So humans should eat just all plants, right? Like that's an appeal to nature fallacy. I think what you're saying is like, if you observe nature, there's consistency in the patterns that you observe. And I think that's more a claim about an observation as opposed to just a pure appeal to nature.
Well, I get accused of appeal to nature on that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it actually is, because appeal to nature would be like, everything in nature is better than anything authentic. So, you know, eat as many cyanide filled apple seeds, eat 1,000 of them and you'll be fine. Or like eat cyanide, see what happens, right? So that's like the extreme example always used.
It's natural.
It's natural, so it's better, right? For the most part, I do appeal to nature. And I think most things that are natural are better. But of course, there's exceptions to the rule, right? But in this case, I do get accused of, when I talk to more scientifically minded people, scientifically being scientism, like the institutions of science, they think it's appeal to nature because prove it in science, right? Like prove it and then be like, well, you can observe it. And they would be like, well, where's the papers? And then there's that argument again, right? So because it's not in the literature, it doesn't exist, or I'm just like, observe the patterns, I'm going to go with that.
Well, I do want to rewind back to this idea of the importance of a blueprint too, because even when I was a personal trainer back in the day, before I got into all this, you know, sort of biomechanics and form training, I had a blueprint that was oriented around squatting, hinging, vertical pushing and pulling, and horizontal pushing and pulling, essentially, and lunging as well, I think was the other one. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do when I have a new client, when you're saying, it's like, oh, I got to figure out, you know, what things will work for this person. Then generally what I would do with a new client was, for the first 2 weeks with them, I would kind of scattershot a lot of different movements, and we would do general exercise, and I would see how they would move, essentially. And I would see what their patterns were, and I would see what their compensations were. And I would see, like, okay, they have mobility. It was in my head. It was like, okay, I need them to be able to squat, lunge, hinge for their lower body, and then push and pull without any like weird scapular stuff going on, and like shrugging their shoulders for their upper body, essentially. And so that was my first, that was my blueprint, right? And I would get them to do all these different movements. And then based on what I observed in their patterning, that's when I would start prescribing specific mobility drills, specific strength exercises, specific stability drills. It was reactive to the person in front of me, but I was trying to get them closer to a blueprint of movement that I thought was appropriate at the time, which was based on a lifting paradigm, right? Like the whole linear lifting, linear movements. If your joints can go through these ranges of motion and you're strong in them, then you're good to go. Now, having a more locomotive and throwing oriented blueprint and a posture oriented blueprint, I wouldn't do that. You know, I would take slow motion videos of them walking and running. That's how I do it first. And then, but I would have the same sort of approach. I would put them through some different drills, see what works, see what compensations they have, see what hurts or doesn't hurt. I had the opportunity to train a friend and her training partner when I was in Mexico, and I went through the exact same thing. It was just with a different blueprint. So, you know, in terms of figuring out what works, I think Adrian Veno has this saying that it's not the exercise that you bring to the body, it's the body that you bring to the exercise. Mm-hmm. And the exercise is going to be, you know, totally different, you know, from you to me, based on our own individual circumstances, our own individual structures and compensation patterns and histories and et cetera. Something that could be like the best thing in the world for some person is going to be terrible for another.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think that still is the standard. Squat, hinge, lunge, push, pull, a couple other ones. I think people actually put in gate now. They're just like gate, squat, hinge, lunge, push, pull, and that's fine, right? I think it's based on a lifting paradigm. I used to use it as well. I think that's completely the standard, and I don't think it's a terrible way to do it. It's a decent way to parse things out, right? Like most people are like, well, everyone's forward shoulders. You got to pull more than a 3-to-1 ratio of what you push. It's something like that, right? I'm sure you've heard that a million times, right? Got to work the hammies more than the quads. Yeah. Got to work the hammies more than the quads to get a better balance because most people are quad dominant. Something like that, right? And again, the appeal to nature I'm having is that we do develop crawling. We do develop locomotive patterns. And if you want to be durable, then work towards that in a smooth fashion. Have a smooth pressure wave. I think I said this before, that if I'm watching somebody walk down the street or run down the street and I see them quiet and just bounding and hopping and their gait is quiet, I'd rather see that than someone like hitting hard and looking straight, looking perfect, right? So it's about how you move pressure through your body. I think that is the muscular system, is moving pressure through your body, just like the vascular system is moving blood through your body. The musculoskeletal fascial system is moving pressure through your body. Now, again, like back in the past, the lunge, push, pull, hinge, squat paradigm comes from more of a lever system paradigm and lifting, moving external objects paradigm versus a smooth pressure wave paradigm. Like, I'm going to grab this. Here's a tensegrity model. And if you see it moving, these sticks are suspended inside the elastics. If I take off an elastic, it's not going to look so good. It all has to be there. And when I turn this, you'll see that the sticks move all over the place, right? This is based on a pelvis model. They're the femurs, right? So there is a smooth motion that happens throughout the body. It's a dance, a symphony of motion through your fascial and muscular system. It's not just one muscle attachment to the other. This is the old paradigm. Here's my quad, pull, pull, pull. Here's the new paradigm. It's all got to dance at once. Okay. And it all coincidentally, and this is my assertion, that there's figure eights all over the place, that there is I don't know if I've showed you this before and I don't have the right analogy. See how like a lot of the muscles are kite shape. Okay. And think about the lat. Okay. The lat is kite shaped. It's inserting into your spine. So I got the props in here today, big time, right? There's the pelvis. Your lat is inserting into these bones right here and then coming out and fanning out to your humerus, right? This is a fan-shaped muscle. But your adductor's also doing this. And your glute's also doing this. It's fanning out, right? And so is your, if you just look at it in a different way, almost like you're just, you know, those holographic images that have different patterns. So you look at it and you're like, wait, is that going left or right? And then all of a sudden you don't know which way it's going. It's the same type of thing, right? My point is the adductor is even fan-shaped. The adductor is supposed to pull back like the, in more of a arc shape to go with your, to go with your glute. So try to follow me on this. You know, OKF we had on the other week, he's like, the glutes stretch like this. I don't know if you can see it, but oh, so if my leg comes in like this, see that? The glutes are stretching. They're in stretch right there. And that's the position you'll see with a lot of sprinters, right? This is right off the line. They're recoiling and then they're coming back and putting pressure into the ground, right? So if you think about it, with the glute is stretch in stretch, okay? It comes out into a bow, what Goethe would call a bow, as the pressure increases, okay? And at that point, the kite of the adductor is now in length, okay? So it's going from like kite shape to kite shape, you know? So, and it creates that, what's it called? That, I would call it a pressure wave, but I would say a figure eight in both of them. And the figure eight's easy to see in the glute, if you just look at it, the femur's coming in, you're going forward, the femur's coming out into that bow shape, and repeat, right? So Goda would call that the heel away at the end, right? Even if you have heel in, it's the same thing. It's still an arc shape. It's not a straight hinge, mm-hmm. right? So my point is, there's figure eights all over the body, and we're designed to do it that way. And coincidentally, there's that shape as well, right? You know how you said you were doing this? Like weights? That's a Weck method thing too, right? Like watch David Weck do it. He does it all the time. He does this. He calls it like a raptor shape.
The ringing.
Yeah, the ringing. And he calls it something else. But basically the ringing. And I learned it off Weck. And I've seen it. Like I've seen Naughty doing it before in his exercises. And this is years ago. And Weck really taught me this like a few years back, probably like 3 or 4 years back. And you can harness that not only for forward motion in your run, but you can do it to turn. If I'm here, I can turn that way real quick, right? So you're harnessing that ringing, that like figure eight shape to turn in different directions using the fascial recoils of your body. So there's more of a 360 application to all this. The point being, again, figure eights everywhere. It's like, you know that meme where the guy's like writing stuff all over the board? He's like the conspiracy guy from... Always Sunny.
Always Sunny.
Yeah. It's just like, there's figure eights everywhere, man. It's like literally a thing, right? So, yeah. Anyway.
Well, and this is something that, if you're going to talk to someone who is a real biomechanics expert or a real biomechanics scientist, you tell them there's figure eights everywhere, man. You're going to be like, what? This is something that is kind of experientially grokked. Once you start to have an interoceptive experience of these pressure waves actually happening, if you just humor it and you try to create a firsthand experience of some of this stuff, this is how I was really sold on it. Like the theory was interesting, but once I felt it myself, if you're watching right now, you may have noticed that I've been walking this entire episode. I've been walking for like the hour that we've been talking. I put this walking treadmill at my workstation so that I could, because I hate sitting all day. Like I'm very fidgety and I'm very stimulated mentally by movement. And I find some of my best ideas come to me while I go for walks. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to set up a walking desk. Now I can walk on this treadmill barefoot for 5 or 6 hours without any aches or pains in any part of my body. Like that is a result of efficient, smooth energy transfer. That is a result of creating the appropriate tensegrity in my system over the last year and a half, 2 years that we've been talking about this stuff. I wouldn't be able to, like, I remember I would get like super sore back when I was working as a waiter, when I was squatting and deadlifting all the time. I would do good. I'd be okay, but I'd constantly be fidgeting or like stretching and like doing these little like hip flexor releases and doing like big long stretches and breathing into my back just to feel a little bit of relief, because there was always an excess tension and I was absorbing all the force from every step that I was taking instead of transferring that energy. I'm sorry if it's distracting too for this episode, you know, like you're seeing that sort of figure eight pattern as I go from column to column on every step. But the only reason that I can walk like 6 hours a day while I work and not have to take a break, you know, like I will take breaks. I'll go like, you know, use the bathroom and get some food and whatever, and I'll sit down when I eat. But you know, I'm just standing and walking for most of the day and like, you know, not needing to break.
It's interesting that you say that. You know how you're like, so I get rid of the tension when you were lifting a lot, and I used to do the same thing. It's like, man, I built up a lot of tension in my lower back just from squatting heavier, doing, you know, thrusters or whatever, right? And is it really tension you're getting rid of, or is it pressure that you want to mitigate? So I think of it more like pressure mitigation, pressure mediation now versus getting rid of tension, because tension is something specific. That's muscle pulling this way. Tension is this.
Right.
Compression is this. Okay, I'm compressing. Here I'm tensing, right? Is it always tension? It's not always tension with the muscular fascial system, right? it is sometimes compression. It is sometimes that the wire is not even electrically on because it's disconnected for one or another reason. I shouldn't say completely disconnected. I mean, less connected than other places for one or another reason. Okay. So what I'm thinking now more when I work with patients is pressure mediation. And this is like over thousands of patients. I'm like, I try to distill things down to what is simple. Okay. What is an easy way for me to tell people like how to pressure mediate is simplicity. It is lay down for 5 minutes a day while you're on your phone, lay down with your feet up 5 minutes a day, three times. Okay. That's something anybody can do. A lot of people are go, go, go. They don't think about their back. Okay. Like, again, in I'm talking from a chiropractor's point of view. People come in with a lot of pain. It's not just like, oh, my back kind of hurts. I need to strengthen it. So I'm going to go to a personal trainer. It's not like that. It's like, I'm 9 out of 10 in pain. I'm really, really, this is distracting to my life. And I'm in high anxiety right now. Right. So you need to get easy wins for the person. Right. And it's about pressure mediation is the simplest way to go about that. And I bring rolling into the equation in that, not foam rolling. I do it very, very, very specifically. Okay. And it depends on the person, but basically I try to mediate pressure. Now that's what I think when I'm working. So I work with, like putting pressure through somebody's body, mechanically. So that's with my hands and my elbows and my, different parts that I do as a chiropractor, high pressure cupping and, mobilizations sometimes, and advice is massive. Advice is almost the biggest part, right? So it's like, here's what to do, here's what not to do, right? And then sometimes someone comes in and it might not even be a physical ailment so much as like an anxious ailment. Okay. So like, I don't know what to do. And this is where the safety component we were talking earlier, like, about maybe we can pivot into what Devin was saying because this is pertinent to it. But when somebody has a massive amount of pain, they call me, they're like panicked. They come in and I'm just like, I reassure them that it's going to be okay. And that here's how to be safe in this position. Here's what's going to hurt. Here's what's not going to hurt. Here's the timeline. Oh, okay. I can breathe. I can relax a little bit. Right. So there's a huge component of safety within
I think we lost you. I think what he was kind of talking about there, and I'm just going to continue riffing on that thought. I think you're back. You're back.
Okay. Okay. Was I on? Okay. Yeah, anyway, basically what I was saying is quiet the noise a little bit on pain. And let's say you're not in pain. You still need a feeling of safety within your body to be able to push power through your body and move fluidly. Okay. So let's say I've been injured and I've had a lot of injuries in my time. Right now I've been dealing with probably 5 years, I'm going to say approximately, of a hip labral tear. Okay. And it's finally getting like, I can push power out of it now because I feel safe on it. It hasn't hurt for a couple months, right? Like at all. So that is doesn't matter what biomechanics I would have done before. Doesn't matter what I would have, anything wouldn't have let me push power out of that because it was just, it needed the feeling of safety. And now that it's been out of pain, out of that inflammatory cycle for a while, I can now push power out of it because it feels safe. But safety is a underrated mechanism within the body, to be able to be smooth, to push power and to work towards. Anyway,
well, this is a good place to pivot into this idea of like, how do you generate that feeling of safety and how much does that safety translate into your body self-organizing during dynamic movement? Because the reality is when we're talking about dynamic movement, we don't think about the patterns that we're in typically, or like, at least when you're forced into. I'm not talking about like in a training setting where you're deliberately practicing a certain technique. Like when you're shuffling, you're thinking about shuffling, right? Like when you're learning your dance move, you think about it, you think about it, you think about it, you keep doing it, you refine it. And then eventually you don't have to think about it because your body learns to put itself in those positions. Now, you know, one of the arguments that Devin made, not on the last podcast, but in his new course, was this idea that our body will self-organize in the ways that it's taught to feel safest and strongest. And the ways that we teach it to feel safe and strong are through strength training, right? And so the stimulus that we put it through. And that's not the entire picture. I think he also talks quite a bit about our resting positions. He talks a lot about our glutes being turned off. And, you know, when we're looking down, we're creating this, like, this text neck situation. So, he you know, there's more nuance to his argument than that. I don't want to straw man it. And just leave out a bunch of nuance that he also includes. But you know, the overall picture here is that your training stimulus is one of the prime areas of your life where you are being taught, or where you're teaching your body, informing your body to self-organize and teach it to feel safe in certain positions. So for example, when you're doing a barbell back squat with your knees out and you're pushing your knees out and you're compressing your glutes because you're externally rotating and driving your knees apart, and you know, like you're teaching your body to extend in that position. When you're in a dynamic situation where you're running and you're pushing weight off the ground, your muscles are going to bias towards that because that's how it's been taught to self-organize under extreme loads and stressful situations. Do you think there's more nuance than that? Or do you think that's pretty much more or less, you can take that at face value?
I agree and disagree. I don't know the exact argument. The argument in my head is that you're training for safety with the position that you do within the training scenario. True?
I think the argument is more the positions that you put yourself in an extreme training stimulus are what you condition your body to feel strongest and safest in. And that is what will show up when you're in dynamic movement situations. That's how you create movement compensations, is because you're teaching your body to handle stress in that particular way in the training setting. And so during movement, that's how your body will handle the stress of movement.
I can see that argument. Like the same argument would be had with somebody who trains regular squats though, right? So it becomes an argument of like, what's the better way to train? Because both are trying to train safety and find yourself in those positions when you're in stress, right? So again, the next level argument would be, what is the better way to train from that? What I was saying more earlier had to do with the feeling of safety within your own body. So the introspective safety, right? So if I had an injury in a certain area, I'll have to compensate around that. I'll have to reorganize around that to be able to complete a task because it doesn't feel safe. I can't push power out of my hip, right? So I understand what he's saying and I agree there, but the argument's always going to come down to what's the best way to do that, right? So, and every system's going to be like, mine, right? We already know that it's squats, guy. Like, come on.
Well, and what's interesting too is that you know, conversely, the Nathan from MoveMed might argue that maybe you don't necessarily even need to do that in a training setting with movement specifics. Maybe it's actually going from in to out, where rather than like having these external relationships that your nervous system is being conditioned with certain movements, that, you know, obviously he still has external stimulus and stuff, but he has more of an interoceptive approach to training, more of a sensations orientation to his training approach. And so you're almost teaching that nervous system safety without having to put yourself in these like training situations. You're teaching it a feeling of comfort and trust, and then it will self-organize more effectively because it can learn that feeling of safety. Now, I don't know, like Nathan's stuff is really fascinating to me because it works really well experientially, but I can't explain it for the fucking life of me. And I've tried, I've had long conversations with him. I have jammed with him about how to articulate some of the stuff and what's happening. And I don't know how to.
Yeah. I've done a session and I have the same thing, right? Like, I can almost see where he was going with it. And it's like, put specific pressures in specific ways within the body and using torque, and the midline stability is the golden thing to go to, your first principle, I believe. I may not even say it because I'm straw manning, right? Maybe. I don't know. So it's a hard thing to articulate The principles from that, I would say, is that you should train at some point in your life to be very, very aware of every part. Okay. Like, I think there is room for really understanding, like, from the tips of your fingers. My camera's just brutal here. From the tips of your fingers to like your jaw, to your breath. Even Nathan does the thing like breathe up instead of, you know, just breathing, right? Like feel it go through your body. Having that introspection is big, right? So people would benefit from this type of training. And in terms of explaining it, I can't really explain it either, right? So yeah, I don't know what else to say about that other than I think that the exercise-based paradigm, I don't agree with it so much. I like the internal paradigm a little bit more, like not just giving exercises. The body comes to the exercise, not the exercise to the body. I like that from Adrian, right? So again, the blueprint is another thing to go back to. Crawling, walking, running, look to the indigenous and the babies. I like how Goda did that. The elderly who move well. And I don't even want to say the athletes because you got people spiraling everywhere about this thing. And it's like, look, I see Chad Johnson with his foot in an inside ankle bone low. Goda debunked. You know, like I have a paper from Mike Israetel saying that it's a peer review paper saying something different. So Goda debunked. I hate Gary. Goda debunked. You know, like it's just ridiculous stuff, right? Like, yeah. Anyway, like we can use the three though for sure. Indigenous not touched by Western culture. Observe. Doing observations, doing more observing, watching babies develop, and guess what? Every single one develops the same. And another thing is, like people are always like,
the baby hold on, do they? Do they though?
Yeah.
Do all like, babies develop the same?
In a framework. Framework. Okay. So they go from crawling to walking and they have to gain their balance. Some go straight to walking, but everybody goes to walking. It's a blueprint. Okay. So like, but the vast majority go from crawling to walking and they crawl very similarly, but have more play within that because their joints are just flimsy as can be. They go in every direction. Right. And half of it is them trying to integrate their bodies into the world that they're like, you know, trying to figure things out. So you'll see a lot of variation there. Okay. I don't think it's as clean cut as like the babies always have their heel away and they just crawl perfectly like this. Everyone's claiming that they know how a baby crawls. I don't think so. Right. Like I think that babies have a lot of variation in how they crawl within a certain framework. Right. So, that framework being across, what's it called? A reciprocal pattern. Okay. Most babies aren't going to slither themselves for too long. Maybe a little bit. They might slither themselves here and there, but it's mostly going to be a reciprocal pattern. And then that develops into your run and walk with variations. I can say why, which is like, I can be like, oh, the baby does this because he wants to get a lordosis or whatever, right? I actually like don't agree with that so much. I can rationalize that to just be like it's within the DNA, within the nature instinct to go from crawling to walking. I know that, right? And we all go towards walking, given that 99% people have that pattern, right? You might have some genetic deficiencies. We're not talking about that. We're talking about 99% will go towards crawling to walking in a similar fashion within a framework. That is the blueprint to go back to. Yeah. Anyway,
I think even just the point of like, hey, there's a blueprint. Like there are, you don't even have to say like, if the word blueprint is like too extreme for you, you can just say, hey, there's consistencies that you can observe amongst human beings as they occur in nature. And the less influenced by modern society they are, you can kind of observe more and more consistencies. You can also observe consistencies in the patterns and compensations of people who are influenced by certain aspects of modern culture. In fact, they're so consistent that you can probably look at a the gait of a weightlifter and the gait of a golf player and the gait of a hockey player and the gait of a someone who sits all day, and you could probably determine who's who just based on like a version of them walking. Now, that's saying something to me. You know, it means that, hey, that if our external environment and our and these external stimuli affect our gait patterns and our movement and our efficiency, then isn't there like a baseline? Isn't there like some sort of like gold standard of what we were supposed to be based on our structure, based on our genetics? Everyone has two eyes, everyone has a nose, everyone has a mouth, everyone has two ears, everyone, you know, like, and again, I say everyone, I'm just a normal 99% average human being. We all are born with these particular features. We're born with a particular preset structure. That preset structure is there for a reason. You know, there's a reason for all of it. There's a function for all of it. So it's not unreasonable to assume that there's a baseline of movement that human beings were designed for or optimized for, or however you want, evolved for, whatever word you want to use.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with that as well. And the dirty secret is that some people are genetically more gifted than others in terms of like athleticism and all that. Like I was having a conversation, I can't remember with who, about this the other day. And they're just like, well, this guy walks like this and I can't figure it out. I'm just like, that guy is a specimen. He's an absolute beast. He's in the NFL. You know what I mean? Like, we're not, remember when I'm like, it's a double-edged sword because I like watching sports and I like showing walking, running, and like 100 meter sprints are very interesting, but this is not who to model around for the vast majority of people because this is an absolute specimen. If you watch, let's take it to the animal kingdom and watch dogs. Some dogs I can walk down the street. I'm like, that's not a very athletic dog. And then like other ones, you'll just see like this pit bull come down the street. And there's like, that dog is like wildly athletic. You know what I mean? Like that dog can jump over that fence easily. You know what I mean? And it's just like, it's not a chihuahua. It doesn't
train to do that either.
It's not a chihuahua. It's a pit bull with 100 pounds of muscle and its limb lengths are perfect, and it creates spring. That greyhound is going to be faster than that chihuahua, sorry, right? But that greyhound isn't going to be able to kill you like that pit bull. And I have a Boston Terrier, so that Boston Terrier could catch a rat like in any scenario. It's wild how to watch them like even like play ball. Like my dog does crazy flips in the air to be able to like catch a ball. And it's just like, you cannot teach that. That is instinct and that is that animal's baseline. Humans have much the same thing. You're going to have people with more genetically gifted attributes just because of their lineage, right? And that's the dirty secret that everyone wants this like clean cut thing to look at. And it's like, that's not how it works, right? So the vast majority of people are average. That's what average means. You're average, right? So we don't always have to go towards... you're not Usain Bolt and you'll never be Usain Bolt. You'll never be Michael Jordan. Sorry. Right. Like that's the dirty secret.
Unfortunately, right? And average is getting worse. I think like that's the real dirty secret is in the last podcast I did for nutrition, I was talking to Dr. Anthony Chafee, who's a carnivore guy. He's an MD, really, really like smart tuned in guy. And he was telling me about a study called Pottinger's Cats, where they took two groups of cats and they fed one group raw meat and they fed the other group cooked meat, and the cooked meat ones started to get really sick. But what was kind of really interesting is that like the next generation of cats that they bred from this cooked meat group had even more health complications. And then by the fifth generation, they were so bad that they like their testosterone was so low, their sex drive was so low, they didn't even replicate. They didn't even like reproduce. They were just like, whatever. Like they're just like sickly, decrepit, like all like super osteoporotic, like low bone density, like just from eating cooked meat, like their non-species appropriate diet. Now that's one change in a cat's, like they're still eating meat. It's just cooked meat. And generation after generation, that made each cat progressively worse to the point where like they couldn't reproduce anymore. You're hearing all these studies about like, oh, you know, the average testosterone of a 22-year-old man in 2020 is the same as the average 73-year-old man 50 or 60 years ago, whatever it happens to be. That's insane. But it's also a testament to how kind of crazy toxic and how messed up our food systems and how our lifestyles have impacted our generation to generation, right? Like we are exposing ourselves to things that we've never exposed ourselves to, not just from a training and biomechanics perspective, right? Like we could talk about the biomechanics I know that Naudi makes a lot of arguments for the biomechanics being a huge influential factor on people's overall health, mental health, physical health, hormonal health. But even, you know, beyond that, there's, you know, there's all the BPA, there's all the like endocrine disruptors that are in different plastic products. And I don't know if 5G signals are a big thing, but we're constantly basting in Wi-Fi and all these like unseen radio signals and frequencies that we've never been exposed to. And that might have an impact on us. In fact, they've shown that like it impacts the way that plants grow, for example. So we have all these different like things that we're like constantly exposing ourselves to. So average is getting worse, which means that, sorry, like you might be a part of, you know, one of these populations that has been exposed to like tremendous amounts of environmental toxins and disruptors and shitty biomechanics. And you have an uphill battle trying to fix your shit.
So let's talk about that. Right off the top of my head, the cat study, very interesting. However, most cats are eating like Purina Chow or whatever it is, right? Like how yeah. bad are they like going to be, right? So it's very interesting, actually. My dog just had lumps on its body, right? So I go into full, like, let's completely change what's here, right? So buying Costco organic food, I'm like, okay, cut that out, because that could be a source of what's happening here, right? So I cut that out. Mm-hmm. I'm giving my dog pure meat and eggs, and I'm getting it from a farm, grass-fed meat, eggs, fish, only ocean fish. And I can see the WOTA scientists right now just being like, no, you can give it farmed fish and soy's good, right? And like, you know, you can give it GMO, whatever, and you can give it farm factory meat, and it's all okay because it's got a stamp of approval on it from credited agencies, right? Like FDA, or what is it, a Federal Food Drug Administration or whatever. And it's okay. And GMOs are good, a net positive. Okay. And seed oils are good. There's no proof that seed oils are bad, so let's pump those too, right? And raw milk is really bad, so let's have factory farmed 2% milk. So basically what I'm saying is I cut out all the crap in my dog's diet. Its lumps are going away. Okay, so I went from thinking it had leukemia to a month later, and also I gave it some secret sauce to get rid of it, and I can't say what it is because it was really bad sauce for a while. It's a secret ingredient, like secret juice, that gets rid of your parasites, and I can't say any more about that. Ends with a tin, starts with an I, okay? And anyway, it was crapping out some crazy worms, okay? So getting rid of the parasites, cutting out all the toxic foods, and giving it raw meat, and I'm reversing what's going on here. Okay, so very interesting case study. So just an interesting. Well,
it's topic. Funny because your dog is probably eating better than 99% of people in North America right now.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it's interesting because it's going against the grain. Like you've seen it. That, or I don't know if you have seen it, but a lot of the scientific scientism guys are like, seed oils are good. What are you talking about? The carnivore diet is too extreme, which may be true.
Yep.
Okay. I don't know about that, but seed oils are good. GMOs are good. They're approved. They're good. Milk is good. The food pyramid's awesome. Okay. And factory farm meat, completely fine, right? So interesting to see what will happen. Oh, and you know, 5G is completely harmless, which I don't even know, right? Like my instinct says this is crazy. Okay, so my instinct just off my like Wi-Fi is hitting you, your cell phone's in your pocket, 5G towers everywhere, it's electromagnetic radiation, which I'm sure they would say it's not in a high enough dose to do anything to a person. There's not any studies, therefore you're a conspiracy theorist, right? So interesting. I'll shut off 5G on my phone and I'll live somewhere where there's not so many towers and we'll see what's what, right? So mm-hmm. I'd rather play it safe and have meat in a farm setting. So family farm, grass-fed, grass-finished meat. And I'm giving the formula now, the solution to what I was saying. Factory farm, fresh meat, made by, with a family. Okay, so it's a family farm. That is spiritually better, in my opinion, than even something you get from a grocery store. So the farmer comes and delivers the meat to me. I have an exchange of energy with the farm, the family farm, five generations mm-hmm. who claim to take care of their cows, right? I've never been to the farm, but they seem like really, really nice people, right? So keeping it local, getting fresh grass-fed, grass-finished meat. I have a source, allegedly. Oh, I shouldn't even say this. There's milk that hasn't been refined so much. I won't say what type of milk it is, but I get that. Okay. So, what else? Not so many plastics. So I eat out of glass. I use glass, for food storage. I don't buy things that are wrapped in plastic for the most part, if I can avoid it. Don't eat soy, no GMOs, organic. But I still wash everything in apple cider vinegar with a spray that I get, a natural spray that takes away the pesticides, because pesticides are everywhere. And I know that they're good, GMO guys. I know pesticides are good because they use that. Have you heard this argument that organic foods are even worse because the pesticides that they have to use, the natural pesticides, are harsher on you than the Monsanto pesticides. Interesting stuff, right?
All right.
And basically, and water that's pure. So I go to a spring for the most part, get my water out of a spring source, and filter it. Is there anything that you do in terms of that, or any comments on that?
Yeah. So for me, the water thing is a big one, because I bought a water distiller and I put my, nice fresh Canmore clean tap water in my water distiller, and the black gunk that came out of the water distiller that was left over from like a gallon of water was so appalling to me. it freaked me out. Now the problem with distilled water is that you're getting rid of everything except for the H2O, right? So you don't have any of the trace minerals. You don't have any of that stuff. So recently I bought some Shilajit, which is a resin, I think from
Himalayas.
Yeah, the Himalayas. I think this one's Siberian mountains, but yeah. Either way, it's like a black resin that has like a lot of trace minerals in it. You dissolve like a grain of rice sized amount in a cup of hot water and you're good to go. I also put magnesium and sodium and potassium chloride in my water, just so that I have some basic trace minerals. I salt the crap out of my food. Same thing as you in terms of the meat. I buy mine from a family farm called the Nielsen Family Farm, Alberta barbecue box. Nice. Sometimes I get it from Gemstone.
Yeah, that's where I get it.
But I always get local Alberta beef, right? Like really, really good farms, really, good treatment to their animals. I'm actually planning on driving to the Nielsen Family Farm to check them out at some point to actually meet them. Because I buy so much meat from them all the time. I generally avoid plants as my general thing. Like if I'll eat some fruit, I usually try to eat fruit that has like a thick skin, like a banana or like a pineapple or something lately, just because like the spray is less likely to, the pesticide is less likely to impact that. I don't generally eat vegetables. I feel a lot better if I don't eat vegetables. And, that's basically it. I try to avoid, foods that I know are going to be high in pesticides. I do the same thing, apple cider vinegar with the spray. And I have like a little thing that I put in water that ionizes the water in a certain way that helps remove the last bit of pesticide residue if I do go that far. But, everything is fucking toxic, right? Like this is the challenge. It's like, you look at every product that you possibly have. I don't drink out of plastic bottles if and when I can avoid it. The water distiller that I have has like this big glass jug that I store my water in. And yeah, I mean, like, same thing, you know, you try to get Tupperware, even Tupperware has the plastic lids on it, right? And so it's like, mm-hmm. shit, like, I can't, I don't microwave my food necessarily, no. But if you microwaved your food, you know, the plastic on the plastic lid for your glass Tupperware is still gonna, you know, be implicated in that. And so, cookware is a big thing too. Like Teflon cookware is something that I'm kind of trying to generally avoid. Like I use a nonstick ceramic pan, and then, generally just try to avoid anything that is like highly processed nonstick Teflon, because that's not the best thing in the world for you either.
That's huge. Endocrine fire tip.
Yeah, it's a big one. It's a big one.
What about supplements? What do you take? Like, you mentioned Shilajit. So, I also take that in a like 2 week on, 1 month off ish cycle. I'm not super, like disciplined with that, but it's around that. And, I'll take, mushrooms, but I make sure that they're North American grown organic. I use a company called Stay Wild. Awesome. Turkey tail.
I've heard of them actually.
So turkey tail, cordyceps, lion's mane, chaga, reishi, and maybe missing one, but basically I cycle them in 3 days to a week. I'm not too disciplined with how I'm doing it because I don't know the best protocol, but I kind of like cycling through them. Basically, I've replaced all my vitamins with mushrooms. And
cool.
I take mushrooms and magnesium every once in a while, Celtic salt, and Shilajit.
Nice. I know there's really cool research on lion's mane in particular in terms of the development of neuron growth. Like that's like a really promising thing. Current supplements that I'm taking, I'm taking something by a company called Mitolife, which I think is Matt Blackburn's company. So it's a vitamin E supplement, and it's specifically oriented towards helping protect from the breakdowns of polyunsaturated fatty acids. So when you eat a lot of PUFAs, a lot of seed oils, a lot of this shit, there's a lot of sort of, I guess, toxic byproduct from when you break it down, when you digest it. The metabolic byproducts of digesting polyunsaturated fatty acids are really harsh on your system. And that includes polyunsaturated fatty acid buildup in your own fat cells. And when you oxidize these fats and you have these PUFAs that are in your fat cells oxidizing and metabolizing, you have a lot of these less than healthy metabolic byproducts. So having this vitamin E supplement when you're oxidizing these fats, and right now I'm in a heavier fat loss phase. I'm trying to drop about like 15, 20 pounds so I can be a little bit lighter to move around and be a little bit more bouncy. And, you know, I'll do like a 24-hour, 36-hour fast, and I'll take this vitamin E supplement like intermittently throughout the day, so that if I, you know, if I'm experiencing a large amount of oxidization of my fat, which is what your body forces itself to do when you're fasting, if there's any metabolic byproducts of polyunsaturated fatty acid buildup in my system, I'm protected in a sense in that way, and I won't feel as miserable. I think that's the majority, right? Like I have a magnesium supplement as well. I have that Pico Ionic Minerals that Ben Pelton, who we interviewed a while back, kind of got me on.
Oh, nice.
So I really like those. I'm just about out of that actually. I should reorder some, but I'm not massive on supplements in general because I eat such a nutrient dense diet. It's just mostly minerals are a big one for me. And then being aware of the fact that I might need a little bit of extra protection from, you know, my body processing through, you know, poor decisions that I've made in the past, helping that transition be like, for example, I quit coffee recently. And, you know, while I was having withdrawal symptoms from that, I had an L-theanine supplement, which just helped the headaches go away essentially. So a lot of water, a lot of hydration, a lot of mineralized water, and an L-theanine supplement to basically just help the withdrawal symptoms disappear. So I've go ahead. Sorry, go.
No, I was going to make a joke. No. I said that I heard that PUFAs are good. Like, the world of scientists say PUFAs are good because, like, you don't have proof that they're not.
You got a really super. Show me the papers. Well, this is the whole thing. But people have talked about, like, you know, people don't really realize that, like, omega-3 supplements like fish oil and stuff, that's all polyunsaturated fatty acids. That's all highly oxidized bullshit for the most part. You know, a lot of the stuff is like, well, this is, you know, again, like if you get into the work of Ray Peet and stuff, you start to realize that a lot of what we're told about nutrition is kind of extremely erroneous from a bioenergetics perspective and even a biochemical perspective. And I'm not like a diehard Ray Peet fan. He has really interesting ideas. I don't subscribe to everything that he talks about necessarily, but it definitely helps you think of things in a more critical way, and really has some damning suggestions and damning evidence for the whole PUFA thing.
In terms of what? And like as
well,
good or bad?
As negative. As like, okay. it's want to avoid polyunsaturated fatty acid consumption in excess as far as you can, like as much as you can, as much as possible. Like, it's really not good for you. In general, people ask me how I eat all the time, right? And it's like, right now I'm doing a carnivore diet just as an experiment, you know, because it's the only diet that I've said like, oh, I have to give this a try. It's the only thing I haven't tried yet. So I'm doing it for 100 days, you know, and like, generally though, the only two fast and hard rules that I have for nutrition for myself have been like no grains, like no wheat, no grains in general.
Yeah.
No grains and legumes, I guess, is what I'll bundle that into. And then no polyunsaturated fatty acids from seed oils and shit, like no high PUFA foods. And that includes avocados or high PUFA, no fish oil, no highly oxidized fats. So those are the two like fast and hard rules. I'll also throw in stuff like, you know, obviously like no food coloring, no highly processed crap in general is like a pretty hard, fast rule. But like, as far as like being a highly restrictive person, it's like, I don't eat grains and I don't eat like excesses of PUFA and like most of the complications. I don't eat vegetables either usually, but like if there's some, you know, a piece or two of asparagus with a steak that I ordered at a restaurant, maybe I'll eat one of them. You know, like I'm not like religious about the no vegetable thing. But generally my energy and my mood and everything is better when I don't eat vegetables too. So it's like, you know, my top three, if you want to be like weird and restrictive, then like no grains, no legumes, no PUFAs, like from seed oil specifically, and limit your vegetables as much as possible. That would be my hot take on nutrition.
I like that. I think nutrition is, I've said this before, is the most confusing of all the sciences, I guess you can say. Everyone has their own opinion, and there's a million different opinions that are all based on evidence, and everyone will claim that their evidence is the best. And there's so many studies out there that you can pick one out and then that'll be your evidence, right? And it's very hard to isolate the variables in this instance, right? Like, are people actually isolating the variables? For the most part, probably not. And doing their own experiments.
Well, even if you isolate variables, right? Like, it's the issue of like isolating a variable or a component of food versus the whole food. And then, you know, you get into like most nutrition research is epidemiology, which is like really unreliable self-reporting and like no account for confounding variables. Like, there's so much wrong with nutrition research.
Not only like, that, so like much wrong with it. If you ate, like, let's say you had meat your whole life and then you cut it cold turkey, is it the same as somebody who's, you know, healthy already and then, you know, cuts meat out? I'm just giving you an example, right? It's not the same thing. Like, different bodies have different chemistry and they're coming into things completely differently, both, you know, mentally, spiritually, and physically. So it's very hard to even do the research on that. I can see the issues there. And, you know, like learning it at school with the biochemistry of it, it's like, is like when you're learning in school, you're shown all these like graphics with like these perfect circles of, you know, one chemical going to the other one, conjugating into another one. And you're shown the biochemistry. You're like, yeah, now I know for sure that biochemistry, you know, cartoon that I just saw is definitely what's happening in my body for sure. Now I know everything, you know? So it's ridiculous. Anyway.
So, you know, in terms of the, like the different people coming into different nutritional things, recently Mark Bell was hospitalized for eating 400 grams of carbohydrates and having like a serious health, like incident from eating that. Now, if you know a lot about Mark's history, he was principally carnivore and low carb for a long time. He had this whole like branding thing called the war on carbs, and he was not eating any carbohydrates for a long time. Now, a lot of people would be like, oh, well, like, you know, he was eating high fat. And so, it affected his insulin sensitivity. And he's like, well, what's interesting about our bodies is that they're very adaptable, right? And so people could look at, they could make all kinds of speculations. My speculation is that, like, our bodies adapt to producing the amount of insulin that our bodies generally need. And it will pre-make insulin to respond to how much carbohydrate is generally, it's exposed to in the form of blood sugar. This is based on the research by a guy named Tim Noakes, who's an exercise physiologist and a nutritionist and a nutrition researcher. I don't want to be quoted on that, but like Tim Noakes is an amazing dude with some amazing research. And he basically explains that, like, yeah, your body will pre-make this insulin, but if you go low carbohydrate for a little while, your body will not pre-make this insulin to help you clear this blood sugar because you're not chronically spiking your blood sugar with carbohydrates. So people will confuse, having a worsened inability or basically an inability to process and handle sugars and have less insulin sensitivity because you're low carb. But in reality, it's just your pancreas is just now like not used to producing that much insulin to handle that much carbohydrate. Now, Mark ate 400 grams of carbohydrates.
Did he say that? What was his claim? Yeah. How did he get 400 carbs? How did he get 400 grams of carbs in him? Like, what was he doing?
So this is the whole thing. He said he started eating carbs, and I'll pull up the post if I can find it here. He basically said he started eating carbs again a little bit more because, I'll just read the post.
Sure.
When life hands you a barf bag, turn it into a cock ring. Okay, not sure where to start. Let's see. Where do I start? I guess I'll just explain this in an upcoming video, but here's the short of it. I've been a low to modest carb guy for many years, even through bodybuilding and not all the time in powerlifting, but still often I was low carb. My transition of running around like a fairy has changed my diet. I added carbs in as activity increased. Yesterday, I got into an odd predicament. I ran really well and felt better than ever. I got through my sixth interval and started my seventh when I was like, I said, shit, maybe I need more rest. I made a compromise and I backed off, but I still ran a bit. Then I decided to call it completely and stop. So I walked. Breathing was fine. I wasn't in pain. My eyesight got a little odd and my legs were getting weaker. At this point, I was like, let's walk to Starbucks in downtown Davis and get more fuel. I had water, carbs, hydration on my run, but I thought maybe I needed more. By the time I got to Starbucks, I was shaky. I grabbed 4 to 5 juices and slammed them with water and salt. This started to exponentially make me worse, as my blood sugar probably wasn't low in the first place. In fact, because I'm used to being low carb, I believe my glucose may have already been cranked. Now I'm really fucked because I just crushed 400 grams of carbs. I could barely speak or stand. I sat and made a decision on what to do as my wife was arriving. Going to a hospital sucks and it's tough to get seen, and I was in a bad way. So I said, call 911. The ambulance got there fast. They checked my blood sugar and it was 380. They hauled me off to the hospital where it took me 5 hours or so to get the strength to stand up and walk out. More details on this to come, but my blood stabilized after puking many times. I got better and better. Run every day came to an end, but I'm so happy with the training I was doing, and I'm even more proud that I was able to kill myself that bad. Years ago, I wouldn't have had the endurance to even make a dent. Now my lungs, legs, and heart are strong enough to take me wherever, whenever. So, he had this speculation that it's like, I thought I needed more carbs, but my blood sugar was already cranked. That's probably because being someone who has been chronically low carb, his pancreas doesn't produce the amount of insulin to clear the blood sugar, because blood sugar is actually toxic for us. This is something that I learned recently, is like elevated blood sugar is toxic. That's why it's such an issue for diabetics who can't produce the insulin to clear the blood sugar from their system. So his pancreas probably wasn't producing enough insulin to clear the blood sugar. He thought he needed more carbs. He cranked it up even more and then had to go to the hospital.
Yeah, that's all interesting. And it shows that, like, you come into, like, if, 25-year-old did that, who, eats 400 grams of carbs, he's probably not going to the hospital, right? Like, no matter how unhealthy he is, right? Or he or she is. It's like, your own chemistry. You come into nutrition with your own chemistry and your own background and your own history, and that really shows that, right? And it's interesting how he framed that psychologically, right? Like, he's going hard at it. It's like that David Goggins thing again, coming in the background, that mentality of going hard, pushing yourself to the limit. I saw this, there's a guy, John Russin, you know who he is? Like, he's like, a fitness, bodybuilder, go hard type guy. And he's like, I'm crushing my legs. I'm destroying my hams and quads. And he's like, that type of like mentality is like, it'll land you in a bad place over a long period of time, I believe. Right. So it's just interesting when people bring that to the nutrition end of it and become extreme. I think problems will arise, especially when you've been extreme in the opposite end in the recent past. Right. So it goes from one end to the other end. Your chemistry can't keep up. And I'm speculating, of course. I don't think your chemistry can keep up. Your enzymes, things don't switch that fast. Right. So that shows that, you know, things are very individual and you shouldn't go from one extreme to the other. And you shouldn't be so extreme on your body, in my opinion. Right now, I'm doing the opposite. You know, the hard 75, I do the soft 75. I'm nicer on my body. And, you know, I don't go so hard on things because that's what I did when I was younger. And you can only keep that for so long, right? So your body needs recovery. I think that, like, I think if I go softer for another couple of years and I still, you know, walk up mountains and ski and do all that stuff, if I go softer on my body and think mentally in that way in a couple of years, I'm going to be recovered enough to go hard again, right? So I don't think it's as black and white in terms of where most people go in terms of nutrition. It's like, let's go extremely off carbs and then let's do extreme carbs because now I have to run every day and do intervals. Intervals themselves imply that you're going hard and then recovering. Go hard, then recovering, because you want a goal of losing fat, and that goal is there in the first place because you're going too hard, right? So it's all kind of tied in psychologically and physiologically.
It is really interesting, man. I mean, like, I've definitely been in that cycle for most of my life. And, you know, just to contrast what happened with Mark with what I'd been doing for, like, my own last diet experiment was how much sugar can I add to my diet and not have any, like, seemingly negative effects, right? And this is like a whole, like, adaptive thermogenesis. This is the more sugar, you know, the more you consume, the more fuel you have, the higher your metabolism is, the more your thyroid hormone gets cranked. So I was eating, like, you know, 1500 to 2000 calories, mostly from sugar extra on top of whatever else I was eating a day. I cranked my daily calories to about 4,400 calories a day and was losing body fat. Like, and most of those calories were coming from sucrose, from sugar, like added sugar. Like, I was drinking like a liter and a half of orange juice and I would put sugar in it and I would have coffee with sugar and milk. And I was like, I was doing the Ray Pete thing fucking hard, man, like pro-metabolic diet to the nth degree. And I did it gradually, right? Like, I gradually increased. I started with like a couple of tablespoons of just plain cane sugar throughout the day. And then I added some honey. And then I was like adding bits and pieces over time. And I cranked my metabolism up to the point where I had to eat 5,500 calories a day to start putting on half a pound a week. Like, that was how, like I could not gain weight. And so I was like, this is really interesting to me, right? And so, you know, contrast that, like, what's 2000 calories is divided by four is, I was eating like 500 grams of sugar a day, give or take. Like, it's a lot. It's a fucking lot. you know, around that, give or take. Either way, I was eating like a ton of, like, that was like maybe my total carbohydrate intake, not just from sugar. That's like from fruit and fruit juices and from you know, from a variety of things. But it was like, that's really interesting to me, man. Like, that's like a totally different metabolic state than someone who is zero carbohydrate. You know, like, someone else is arguing that, like, you know, oh, you need to crank your sugar for the thing. The conversation I had with Dr. Anthony Chafee, he's like, well, actually, I think like the ketogenic state is the human being's default metabolic state. You know, if you look at a wolf who's hunting, they did these studies on wolves. It's like, man, they're running for hours. And it's like, do they have blood sugar? It's like, yes, they do have blood sugar. And it's rock solid the entire time that these wolves are running for a hunt because that's their default metabolic state. They're able to mobilize and regulate their blood sugar very naturally because they're eating their species appropriate diet. and they're not spiking their insulin and they're not doing all this stuff. And so they don't become dependent on exogenous forms of this blood sugar spike. And so they're always at this like nice stable level of blood sugar. His argument is like human beings should be doing the same. It's stressful for us to like be spiking it all the time with these exogenous carbohydrates and all this stuff. So again, nutrition is a weird one because so many people have so many different opinions, but like it is really interesting to see the extreme approaches that people take just to like handle problems. It's like they have an issue, they have a problem, so they have an extreme intervention to try and handle it.
It's very interesting. Out of all these episodes, you've hardly ever heard me talk nutrition. And in fact, I don't even go on the episodes that you do with nutrition because I don't feel like I know enough. I've studied it at school, but again, it was biochemistry and, you know, I don't know how to eat. And it's not an area that interests me so much. And I feel like over the years, I've seen so many different diets come and go, fads come and go. There was vegetarianism. I'm sitting here not being vegetarian. That kind of went away. Carnivore, kind of, you know, it's on the rise, but I think it'll be too extreme and people will kind of go away from that, right? I've seen so many different types of diets, keto, whatever, this and that go away. And I'm sitting here like, I've done none of this. And all I'm really doing is avoiding processed foods, eating a good balance of, you know, farm meat and fruit and a little bit of vegetables, right? And don't eat anything processed, don't eat grains, and that's pretty much it, right? Not extreme, but again, I feel amazingly healthy, don't have a lot of issues there, or any issues there. And I see these diets just like go with all these people arguing around me about their definite positions. And it's just interesting that that happens, right? Like I stay out of the game and just observe, and you see the extremes come and go. And maybe the middle ground that I have is pretty on point. I don't know, without knowing anything. I shouldn't say anything. I know quite a bit, but like compared to the average like person who peers into this, I feel like people become obsessed and look at everything and become like obsessed with
exhibit
it,
A,
Dr. Saladino and Dr. Eric Berg. And this guy's got it now. And this guru. And again, that guru thing is coming into play because everyone's got one, even the scientific guys. Like, you don't think people think that Greg Lehman is the man. He knows all the research. That's your guru there. Or Squat U has your Stu McGill's the guru there. It's the guy who amalgamates the research to that they look up to. And then they're like, oh, I only look at the science. It's like, no, you look at the guru who's looking at the science and you trust the guru. That's what everybody does at school. Come on. That's what everyone does at school. Same thing with the nutrition guys, right? So it's like your guru guy again, Carnivore MD. You can even say Carnivore Aurelius in there, right? On Instagram. You have your the guy that you had on before is a carnivore guy.
Yeah, Big Jack,
the older guy. No, Big Jack, the older guy.
Oh, Sean Baker. Sean Baker, there's Thomas DeLauer, there's fucking Bart K on the carnivore side. You got then you got all the vegans, right? You have like Dr. Michael Greger, who are some other prominent ones. I guess even YouTubers, right? Like Vegan Gains and Mike the Vegan, all these people that like pull up and amalgamate a bunch of different research can kind of end up being these Frank Tufano, for example, was a carnivore who's like not a carnivore anymore. He calls himself the nutrition genius or something along those lines.
I always love the guys who switch sides.
Yeah, it's pretty
you know, it's pretty interesting psychologically. I love the psychology behind it, if anything, right? Like the psychology of watching people do something extreme and then go away from it, you know. It's like it's pretty interesting stuff. You see it everywhere, right? So and I've been a part of it too before in many respects, right? Like there's the CrossFit mentality, there's the lifting mentality, there's the you know, right now you could even say the biomechanics mentality, even though I don't think it's as extreme, but maybe it is from somebody on the outside, right? And then there's you know, before it was like in the CrossFit world, when I was in it, it was eating bacon and like bacon grease over everything. That made me sick, by the way. That was brutal, right? So Like, I got real sick from that, actually, the once. Eating just bacon grease on everything. Yeah, I got jacked, but I got sick. So, yeah. Anyway, the psychology is super interesting. I love seeing people who go against the grain or really into one thing and hearing their story about how they did it. Very interesting. I'd like to get like a, let me see, someone who is very invested in a certain topic and goes against the grain, and I want to hear their psychology. I don't even care about the conclusion. I just want to hear the psychology, you know? So like, maybe we can have some people on that. Anybody who's like invested, let's say I want like Vegan Gains on here or something, and hearing his like, his thoughts on the psychology of why he's doing it.
Right.
You know, and like,
yeah, well, I think, you know, and it's interesting. A lot of the times I feel like it's because people feel they're right. You know, I think people will take, and I'm speaking from my own personal experience and also from what I've observed in the mentality of others when I'm kind of like breaking down, not just what people are saying, but the confidence that they're saying it in, or the level of authority that people assume when they state certain things. I was vegan for 2 years. I thought with absolute fucking certainty, I had the papers, I had the mountains of research, and I'd read all the books, and I had all the arguments. I could speak with the authority of good research behind me about why a whole foods plant-based diet was one of the healthiest, most sustainable diets that you could have for your life. And, you know, and I bought that hook, line, and sinker, man. Like I defended it. And there were a few things that basically turned me around from it. One was that my health degraded and I couldn't keep saying, but the paper is the thing that I'm healthy. When my stomach was exploding and my mental health was like destitute, essentially, I finally had to like face reality, like just the facts of reality. And then the other thing was I started reading books about agriculture. I read one book in particular called Dirt to Soil, which is by a farmer named Gabe Brown. And he talks about the process of using cattle to reverse desertification, which is basically depleted soil and making a land barren, where you can't grow crops, you can't grow plants. And it's usually from over farming or monoculture crops and whatever else we happen to be doing to land, and how you can use holistic pasture raised cows, holistic managed pasture raised cows, to reverse desertification and like turn these barren, destitute lands into these flourishing paddocks where you can grow and raise meat. And that sent me down this whole rabbit hole of regenerative agriculture and looking at agricultural practices and realizing that the whole trope about, you know, raising cows in particular, cattle in particular, was a negative thing for the environment. And I was like, oh shit, I was lied to about that. That was just like an oversimplification for a particular agenda. Interesting. Then I learned about all the health consequences. I learned about how saturated fat being demonized for heart disease was from a misinterpretation of the research of a dishonest scientist named Ansel Keys, and how saturated fat is actually a very essential nutrient to our health and our well-being and our cognitive function. All very, very interesting stuff. So it's like I found new information that because I had a break in my ego from getting sick, right? I was like, maybe this isn't working. Maybe all the science is wrong in some particular way. Now, most people don't have that break in their ego. Most people will either ignore reality or not know how good they don't feel, right? And like they won't have an awareness of how good they could feel. And so I think that like break in the possibility of another argument just never reaches them. And they're so stuck and wrapped up in their confirmation bias until something happens, until they get a crack in their ego, until something bad happens.
Yeah, that's usually how it works. Pain is a good way to switch people up. When people get injured in like lifting, there's definitely an ego check there, and am I doing the right thing check. You know, in your time during vegan, it depends on why you would do it, why you drew the conclusion. Some people do it because they believe that animals being harmed is not a good thing, right? So that's why they're vegan. Mm-hmm. And then who cares if you're sick? You sacrifice yourself for the world, right? So there's that mentality behind it. The science-based carnivore guys and, you know, science-based guys in general would just say he doesn't know how to look at studies. These are the real deal right here. These studies, right? So there's so many angles to it and so many ways you can draw the conclusion of becoming a vegan or a carnivore guy or anything extreme or any diet, drawing the conclusion. And well, how do I say this? Like, I'm not so interested in the conclusion. It's more of like how you got there. That's interesting psychologically, you know?
Right.
Yeah. We should have someone on who has an extreme, extreme position and just ask them psychological questions behind it. Cause it's very interesting stuff. Even guys within our field, it's like, you see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, yeah. We never really ask on the psychological end. I'd like to get into some psychology, more psychological questioning. So yeah, maybe we can do that in the near future, but I do have Absolutely. To roll.
Yeah, we'll wrap this episode up. Guys, thank you so much for checking out another lengthy and in-depth episode of The Art of Move. This went a lot deeper and longer than we both anticipated, I think. If you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe and leave us a comment what you thought. And if you're watching on Spotify, well, Spotify is now video friendly as well, so that's pretty cool too. If you're watching on any other platform, we still love you. Come find us on Instagram on at anthony.manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L-E for myself, and for Will is at The Art of Move. We'll catch you on the next episode, guys.